This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We begin with a consideration of human mortality. Pretty apt times to do that. Average global life expectancy rose by 5 years between 2000 and 2015, continuing our general trend of living longer as medicine advances and the fight against disease and infant mortality is making progress. But what about the limits of our lifespans? Harvard researcher David Sinclair said the first person to live to 150 has already been born. But new research published in Nature this week is a little less optimistic. Here with this story and other headlines is Popular Science senior editor Sophie Bushwick. She joins us in our CUNY studios. Welcome back, Sophie.
Thanks.
So let's talk about it. How long have I got?
Well, so when they talk about this particular study, it's distinct from sort of average human lifespan. Like you said, average human lifespan has been increasing due to a lot of breakthroughs. But when you look at maximum human lifespan, that's a different factor. And so what these researchers did was looked at maximum human lifespan over time, and they found that it increased fairly steadily through from the 1970s through the 1990s, and then it sort of plateaued. And it's been plateaued ever since, and this has sort of led them to conclude that about 115 is probably the cap on maximum lifespan. There will be exceptions. So the woman that we know of who has lived the longest lived to age 122. She died in 1997. But the researchers say this is probably an exception. There's going to be a few exceptions, but in general, the odds of someone living past age 120, any human on Earth, is going to be like 1 in 10,000.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So she was an outlier, as they would say in the statistics. Is this because of anything we're eating, our nutritional habits or food or anything like that?
No. So what happens for a lot of the people who live to the longest amount of time, they tend to have survived the era when a lot of other people die of cancer or of a lot of diseases that strike the elderly. But the issue is that as you age, your cells get worse at repairing themselves, and your body in general accumulates wear and tear and is just not as good at recovering from that. And so when you die, it's the sort of death by a thousand paper cuts almost. Sort of your body just reaches that point. And that's what they think is causing people to die at 115. And that can't really be fixed by eating a healthy diet.
It could be fixed if you have better genes. Maybe,
well,
right?
There are other researchers who say if we could have a breakthrough in treating that particular type of wear and tear and making the cells better repairing themselves, that sort of medical breakthrough could increase that age.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something that's on everybody's mind this week. And Hurricane Matthew, it reached Florida yesterday after killing lots of people in the Caribbean. It was briefly the first Category 5 hurricane in the Atlantic since 2007. Why is this storm so deadly, and how do you rate this storm compared to others?
So the hurricane, it reached Category 5, which has to do with wind speed. Mm. So the speed of the wind is what puts it in the category. And Categories 4 and 5, at those wind speeds, it can cause devastation to, you know, even well-built houses can be destroyed by wind moving at that speed. It's now a Category 3, and I think they've got a maximum sustained winds of about 120 miles per hour, which can still do a ton of damage. But they're actually expecting most of the damage is going to come from the storm surge caused by the hurricane. It's going to that's what caused most of the damage in Haiti. And especially an issue because the hurricane isn't just moving onto land. It's moving up the coast. It's moving parallel to the land. So it can cause storm surge over a much longer stretch of shore.
Makes me wonder, well, why don't they include storm surge in the category ratings? You know, we have wind. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's storm surge if it does most of the damage. They should adjust those ratings to include storm surge.
Yeah, maybe. I think it depends because this particular storm, again, moving parallel to the coast, that's not the type of thing they have a category for. They predict how far up it'll go, but they don't. Maybe they should start categorizing like what the length of shoreline that it damages will be.
No, this is a very powerful storm. Maybe it does conform to the climate change, global warming models of maybe fewer hurricanes but more powerful ones.
It's really hard with those models to tie any individual storm definitively to global warming. But, yeah, it's true that models of what happens when the whole globe gets warmer. It affects a ton of different things around the planet. And yes, one of those is storms.
Yeah. Let's talk about this week was big for the 2016 Nobel Prize winners. We had medicine, chemistry, and physics. You want to pick one out?
Well, I thought the medicine prize was really interesting. That went to a researcher who studies autophagy, which is sort of, that literally means self-eating. And it has to do with how cells deal with damaged or unused parts. They can break them down and they can use them to rebuild themselves or use them as food. And so the really cool thing about that is that's controlled by genes. You can look at this researcher was looking at how genes affect autophagy. And to go back to the story about longevity, autophagy is one of the things that contributes to aging. And so learning more about it could maybe lead to, you know, the medical breakthrough that researchers are hoping will push up our maximum life, our maximum age. But it also has to do, it's involved in diseases such as diabetes and I think Parkinson's as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about chemistry. Anything of note that we could
understand
chemistry
is really cool.
Chemistry.
Okay, so chemistry is basically like a very, very tiny machines made out of molecules. So it's a molecule that, say, if you stimulate it with an electric current, it'll start rolling across a surface. I mean, that example is sort of makes it sound more like a party trick, but these things are incredible. They can be used to find HIV. They can be used to target and kill cancer cells. They can be used in smart materials. These are materials that, you know, might be able to be self-healing. So there's a ton of different really cool applications for them.
Yeah, because we forget that chemistry is molecules, actually little objects.
Yep.
That could move around and do sorts of stuff like that. And physics.
Yeah, so physics went to researchers who use a mathematical concept called topology to study these materials like superconductors and superfluids. And these are, so the superconductor is a material where it's got zero resistance when electrical current can flow through it with zero resistance. And a superfluid is sort of like the fluid version. It's a fluid that can flow with zero friction. And by using topology to study them, the researchers have learned more about what makes a material transition into becoming a superconductor or becoming a superfluid.
Yeah, well, exciting stuff. You know, they also talked about, I love topology because it's the science of why a donut is the same as a teacup.
I like that one too, yeah.
It's got one hole. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Sophie.
Thanks for having
me. Sophie Bushwick is a senior editor at Popular Science. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. The Nobel Prizes, we just talked about them, they are an annual tradition which honors important discoveries in chemistry, physiology, or medicine and physics. And the prestige of the prize imbues the winners as people with the brightest minds receiving the field's highest honor. What could be bad about that? Well, in reality, the Nobel Prize isn't necessarily the feel-good story we think it might be. There's a fly in the ointment, maybe even more than one. With us to discuss the good and bad Nobel Prize edition is Dina Fine-Marin, editor for Medicine and Health at Scientific American. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, good afternoon.
So do we all know that the Nobel Prize looks like what it looks like today, but what was the original purpose of the award? What were Mr. Alfred Nobel's intentions here?
Sure. So his original intentions were to actually honor great work that happened in the last year. Obviously, we've deployed quite, or rather, we've gotten quite far from that now that the average prize is given 20 to 30 years after a discovery. But originally, he created this prize in his will to try to honor interesting accomplishments in the last year, and they were specifically in fields he himself was interested in or that he himself had worked in. That's why the original categories were medicine or physiology, chemistry, physics, literature, and peace.
But even though we've been giving out these awards for over 100 years, I mean, it's good that these people are getting the awards. That's the good thing. There are some issues with them. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, of course, one of the biggest issues is that only three scientists can get the award in any category. And really, science now, that's not how it works. Much more frequently, there'll be a team of dozens or even hundreds of researchers working on a given project. But they're really become the footnotes of history, because when someone wins a prize, if you are not one of them, people forget that you were involved at all. Scientific American, for example, has suggested allowing Nobels to go to organizations instead of individuals. So a team of dozens of researchers would get the award for something like uncovering, accelerating the expansion of the universe rather than an individual. Also, obviously, the category limitations can be troublesome. If you are a scientist that works in geology, for example, there isn't an award for you. Sometimes, like in 2007, the Nobel Peace Prize was given for work on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. So they still won a Nobel Award, but it wasn't in one of these sciences traditionally. So perhaps it doesn't have the same level of prestige. And obviously, these awards don't occur in a vacuum either. Nobel Prizes, as a rule, are not rescinded, so the committee choosing the awards may be reluctant to give the prize to a new discovery that hasn't accumulated a lot of backup data yet. And consequently, this year, for example, a lot of science watchers thought the discovery of CRISPR would win for medicine, and new discoveries as far as gravitational waves would win for physics. Neither of those won.
Yeah. I had them on my list. I lost on that one. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Me too. They're subject to this political environment and natural hesitation to give the award to new or controversial work.
Can the Nobel Committee take it on itself to fix this sort of thing? I mean, didn't they add an economics prize that the Nobel didn't have at the beginning, too?
They did. It's true. People who really watch Nobels consider the economics prize not one of the originals, so it's sort of in an othered category, but they certainly could go about trying to fix it themselves. And one of the things that a lot of scientists and a lot of journalists and science watchers have called for in recent years is more awareness about internal bias that might factor into who gets the awards. It's not hard to notice this last year, for example, the winners were all older white men, and that's true throughout history. Most awardees have fit that category. Since 1901, with the first awarding of the Nobel Prizes, only 48 women have won in any of the categories, and only two of the almost 200 physics winners were women. And there have been a couple scientists in particular that people have been saying for years should really have won in that category, who also happen to be female, and yet they have not won as of yet.
Okay. Only women most people know is Marie Curie. Thank you for taking time to be with us, Dina.
Thanks.
Dina Fine-Marin is editor for Medicine and Health at Scientific American. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to unveil your picks for our Golden Record 2.0. All the stuff, we have our judges out. We had hundreds of submissions. See if your name's on the list. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Over the last 3 weeks, we've been celebrating the legacy of the Golden Record, a recording which is attached to each of the two Voyager spacecraft, still on their continuing missions into interstellar space. Spacecraft launched almost 40 years ago. And at that time, a small team of scientists and artists, including astronomer Carl Sagan, writer Andrian, and SETI researcher Frank Drake, collected the sounds and images they felt encapsulated our world. Like the music of Mozart, a photo of a nursing mother, and the sound of a kiss. But so much had to be left out of that original golden record. After all, it was made in the image of a vinyl LP, so not much room for data. Well, a lot has changed about our culture and our history as humans in the intervening decades. Now, what if a second golden record were to be sent into space today? Would it look vastly different? We asked you, our listeners, to tell us what you would put on the Golden Record 2.0, and we got lots of answers. Emily M. from Colorado suggested Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed.
Richard C. in Buffalo wanted to include the sound of a child being tickled around age 4. And Eric S. from San Jose, California said, how about a little prince? Nothing compares. Those sounds, along with images and videos, are on our website at sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord. We had so many suggestions for what to include on a new record that we asked for help in narrowing down your suggestions into a top 30 list. And those judges join me now to discuss their favorites. Maria Popova is founder of the website brainpickings.org and an MIT fellow. Kim Stanley Robinson is a renowned science fiction author, most notably of the Morris Trilogy. And Seth Shostak is a senior astronomer at the SETI Institution. Welcome all to Science Friday. And if there's still time, if you're out there and you want to make a suggestion for our next Golden Record, give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Tell us what you would include on a Golden Record today. Maria, so I know we gave you a very difficult task, but you managed to curate this list of items for the next Golden Record. You know something about curation. I know you do. So tell us, what did you think of our listener suggestions?
It was fantastic, and it was very widely representative of what we're capable of. I wasn't convinced it was particularly honest about our flaws, but I do greatly appreciate the positive.
Yeah. Well, tell us then, what was your favorite? You're judging the 30? What was your favorite?
My favorite was actually what came as my second favorite when we did the live event the other week, where I chose something else. And the second favorite was Dr. King's I Have a Dream. And the reason I hesitated to include that originally was that it's very particularly American. It deals with a piece of American history and of the American experience. And although it speaks to greater human issues of social justice and human rights, it's a piece of American history. But the reason I think it's the best of the list so far is that of the original compositions on the 1977 Golden Record, one was a Bulgarian folk song, which Bulgaria was under 500 years of Turkish slavery. And that folk song, that type of music, was how people survived. It helped them deal with this pain of mass murders and rapes and massacres and beheadings for 500 years, and gave form to that pain and also helped them transcend and see hope, not unlike the way gospel music arose in the American South. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to speak Bulgarian or know European history to feel that pain deep in your bones, but also the transcendence. And Dr. King's speech has that same quality. His words carry something larger and difficult and true and beautiful.
Very nicely put. Seth Shostak, I know you work with SETI, so I imagine you're performing this thought experiment before. What criteria did you use when picking your top listener suggestions? And give us your top choice.
Well, I have to say that a lot of these suggestions, very appealing, all of them, but they were appealing to me. And I have to ask myself, okay, well, what would appeal to the aliens, if you will, the recipients? Because, you know, this whole matter of, well, should we tell the aliens, for example, not only good things about ourselves, but also some of our shortcomings, as Maria suggested, that to me sounds like the Arawak Indians down in the Caribbean in 1492, you know, having a big debate about what should we tell anybody who steps off a ship coming from Spain into the harbor here. It really doesn't matter. But one thing I would say is that greeting card messages, short things, you know, pictures, a few things like that, it's much better, to my mind, to give them a lot of information, because then there's some chance they will understand it. Yeah, an LP, you know, as was sent out on the Voyager spacecraft, you can't get many bits into that. But these days, you could put a thumb drive in there and send, you know, the Library of Congress. I think that's a better idea, because I think they would understand a lot more of it, because there's just more information.
Now, so you would send the whole Library of Congress, or?
I'd go beyond that. I'd send the Google servers. I would just send the entire internet, because think about it. Yeah, well, look, you know, their computers will scan through it and they'll find all the redundancies. For example, well, one word might be AUTO. Now, they don't even know that's a word, let alone what it means, but they find it occurring probably millions of times, along with pictures and videos and sounds and all that stuff. So then they can correlate all that stuff. Now they know what AUTO stands for. So it's like deciphering the hieroglyphics, because it's so redundant, you begin to understand it. That's why I'm kind of against the greeting card idea.
I gotcha. Stan, as a science fiction author, you live at the intersection of science and culture. Did your writing influence how you made your topics?
To a certain extent, it's a message to the future and then also a message to the other, at least in theory. I think we have to also realize that it's very, very unlikely that anybody's ever going to get this message. It's really a shot, a message in a bottle out into an infinite ocean. So then the question becomes, well, why are we doing it, and what are we saying by this? And so it's a kind of a species statement, and that, I think, makes it a form of literature. And I would agree with Seth, more is better. In essence, you give up on the choice at that point and say, well, let's just send everything. Yeah. If you were to choose one thing, I'm thinking about the aliens. Are they alien, so alien that they look at this thing and it means nothing to them? And so I would send something really simple for the start, like pi, which you can do as a diagram and as a bunch of dots. Do they see that, a circle and its diameter come to, pi, 3.1419, et cetera, or is pi for them, 2.9, and they think, wow, these people live in a different kind of reality than we do. So this would be a kind of first step of communication, which is a very hypothetical communication indeed.
Mm-hmm. May I just be the voice of dissent for a second? In terms of this more is better paradigm, even here on Earth, we have an incredibly difficult time synthesizing meaning from mere information. I think the purpose of a capsule like this is to communicate the meaning of who we are, and we cannot mistake it for bits of information that are less than the sum of the parts.
So you use just the basics, you're saying?
No, I'm saying we need to think about what communicates the meaning of who we are,
right,
that is different from the data of what we do, what we look like, what we read, the larger, higher order questions that cannot be answered by just a hodgepodge of data.
Do you think that the aliens would be able to put that all together, understand?
Well, then we get into the question of consciousness. Will they have the kind of consciousness necessary for understanding ours? Because ultimately, we're trying to communicate to them our consciousness.
Stan, was that you jumping in? I wasn't. Somebody was.
Well, I'm just thinking that a language without a dictionary, they're not going to have a Rosetta Stone. This is why I was thinking that the works of Shakespeare, as much as I love them, would just be incomprehensible to the aliens. So if this is a message off to other intelligences in the universe, it's what can they understand? And that's why I go to the physical constants to see if they live in the same physical dimensions that we do, just as an attempt to communicate. Because meaning is very much of a human construct that depends on language. And they are not going to be able to understand our language. We've got some ancient languages here that we never found a Rosetta Stone for, and they're just marks on stones or in clay. We never have been able to interpret them. And so then the question becomes, is this a real attempt at communication, or is this just a
symbolic
statement
gesture
of who we are?
Yeah, yeah. Well, if I could jump, Kim obviously has more imagination than I do because he's suggesting that their value of pi is different from ours. But I would suggest to Kim that if their value of pi really is different from ours, they live in a different universe or a different part of this universe, and they're not going to be able to pick up this spacecraft and ever look at this record. So I'm not so worried about that. But I do think that sending more is better. I will push back a little bit on Maria on that, because indeed, just what Kim said, they don't know English. They always do in the movies, but in reality, they may not. And as a consequence, by sending lots and lots, having a huge corpus of information, there's a much better chance they'll understand at least some of it. Beyond that, remember, it's going to take a long time for them to get this bottle, right? I mean, even if they're at the nearest star, it takes 70, 80,000 years for this spacecraft to get to them. So this is very slow communication. It's better to fill that bottle with as much as you can because you don't get another chance for a long time.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Donna in Aurora, Illinois. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Hey there.
Hi there. I would include, I'm not sure if this is on the old one, a waterfall or a creek. Is that on the old one?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
There is water, but I don't think it's a creek.
Right, because I was thinking, sure, they might have a wave. But with a waterfall or a creek, then you also know that we have land. And if not for land, we would never have evolved to the intelligent beings that we are now.
And, of course, water is so necessary for life on our planet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. See, judges, what do you think? That's a good suggestion. Water?
Water's good. it tells them that we're probably biological. I mean, you know, the aliens may not be. They may have moved beyond that, the limitations of biology. I think we're all aware of that if we're over 30.
Mm-hmm. And also the notion of water in movement, that movement is such a central piece of how life operates on Earth.
Stan, your list includes two animal contributions, a bird song chorus, which was suggested by Edward R. from San Jose, California, and dolphin vocalizations, which were submitted by Susan F. from Pensacola, Florida. Was that intentional?
Yes, it was. I was thinking that giving all the a message from Earth that the other species would be important to include, and also it skips the problem of meaning that we've been talking about, and it goes straight to just the sounds of our planet and also to something beautiful. And so all of the musical suggestions I also think fit with birdsong and with dolphin vocalizations. They're all music. They're all beautiful. And then whether the alien recipient can understand them or not, they might appreciate them just as sound.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. Talking about what would you put on a new golden record with Maria Popova, Kim Stanley Robinson, and Seth Shostak. And if you'd like to give us your suggestions, we still have time, 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. A tweet from Asra Ali Abbas, who says, just pictures of people, old, young, richest of rich, poorest of poor, that gives a window into what we value as well. So there are people, and we have some callers also thinking we need to put, as Maria said, we need to get some of the bad parts, the things we're not so proud about, because this is part of whom we are, right? What about, you talk about putting so much on the record. There are people who are fearful of letting aliens know that we are actually here. What do you say to those?
I mean, one thing that we need to, I think, get out of the way first is that the Golden Record originally had two purposes. One was the scientific, of communicating with another life form across the universe, but the other one was the humanistic and the poetic, which was communicating with humanity about who we are, holding up a mirror to ourselves and reflecting on what our foibles are and what our greatest strengths are and how we want to be represented. And I think that part is still the more important one, especially in our divisive time today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To your point, Ira, the spacecraft itself, of course, will tell any aliens, including the hostile ones, if they're out there, you know, that we're here, that we're technically adept, and also where we are, because they can, you know, just run the trajectory of the spacecraft backwards and find out where Earth is. So if you're really worried that they're going to launch their interstellar battle wagons and wipe us out because they just didn't like the record, or some other, you know, malevolent thought, you know, that we've already told them that. So I don't think that depends very much on the message content. In fact, I don't think any of it depends on the message content in terms of sending information into space, because if they can come here, if they have that technology, they also have some very big antennas, and they're probably watching reality TV, if not now, but when
keep
it reaches
them away.
Yes.
I know there were some overlaps in your picks. In fact, all three of you chose to include the human genome, which was suggested by a number of people, and I actually thought maybe we should send some DNA, actual DNA, if we could get it to be viable. Why is this such an obvious choice? And in what form would you send out, Maria, what form would you send out the genome?
My first silly thought was that it would be very fun to send a Q-tip, the way you do genetic testing here on Earth. It's what we're made of, and what we're made of has been the springboard from which we've leapt into what we've been able to achieve. So without that, there's very little we can say about ourselves that is truly representative of who we are.
Mm-hmm. And another theme that was curated on the list was children. A lot of people wanted children. Mm-hmm. We heard in the intro the sound of a toddler being tickled, and you chose, Maria, the book The Little Prince to include on the Golden Record.
Yeah, that was my original top pick, which with the caveat that I don't think it's a children's book. I think it's a work of philosophy. But it is a story that's wonderfully honest about who we are, about the greed and vanity and hunger for power that we're capable of, as well as the transcendence and the largeness and generosity of spirit.
Okay, we're going to take a break on that nice note with our judges, Maria Popova, founder of brainpickings.org, an MIT fellow, Kim Stanley Robinson, the renowned science fiction author, most notably of the Mars trilogy. Seth Shostak is senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, looking for signs of extraterrestrial intelligence. And if you have some terrestrial intelligence you want to call us, you can be more than invited, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-E-I-F-R-I. We'll take a short break, come back, and talk lots more about the Golden Record 2.0. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're unveiling your suggestions for the Golden Record 2.0, and we have our panel of experts with us, Maria Popova, Kim Stanley Robinson, Seth Shostak, and you can view the list that they helped curate based on your suggestions. All you have to do is go to sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord, and there it is. Let's go to some of the tweets that are coming in. People are wondering, Golden wonders, is Golden Record 2.0 in danger of giving away the store to an unfriendly alien culture? Another one is, send videos. Wayne Reeves wants to send videos of people dancing, everything from waltzing to breakdancing. A Dunkmentary says, I would like to see comic books with vivid photos easily depicting stories through the illustrations sent. So there's some of the suggestions that are coming in. Now, I'm going to go around the table once more and get your top picks. I'll start, Maria, with you.
I'd love to include the chirp, the sound that LIGO recorded of the two black holes colliding, in part because it shows that we're a listening species with a friendly curiosity about the universe, but also because the story of LIGO itself, which Jana Levin tells beautifully in her book Black Hole Blues, is a testament to the human spirit, to this improbable triumph a century in the making, which reveals us to be a species endowed with curiosity and ingenuity and incredible doggedness in the face mm-hmm. of odds against us.
Mm-hmm. Stan, what's your next pick?
I'd send, following up on that tweeter, visual images, movies, a whole library of movies, as many as you could fit in, documentaries and fiction. The aliens watching them would see what we're like, see what our world's like, and they could compare maybe a documentary on Apollo 13 with the fictional movie Apollo 13 and maybe catch a sense of what we're up to and at least see what's going on.
Yeah, I guess visually it's not hard to convey a message that way, right? You don't have to translate it. We get to see what it is.
Well, that's right. This is something you can look at rather than read, and then they can draw their own conclusions, perhaps.
Mm. Seth?
Well, there was a suggestion to put a GoPro on themselves and document their day, a regular person doing regular things. I think that that's a very interesting thing. I would be interested in that, even as a human, not as a Klingon, if I were born, say, a century hence, or to put it another way, if Julius Caesar had done that, had the capability to do that, and had left us a video document of his day, think how interesting that would be. That would tell you a lot about the level of their culture in any case.
Think about how much we're creating now for 2,000 years from now on this planet.
Well, in fact, probably within 50 years, it will be very commonplace that you just document everything that you do all day, that you're just wearing a little bit of technology that allows you to do that, and that way your descendants can relive your life.
Some reason I have a feeling that somebody is already doing that.
mm-hmm. TMI. Too much information.
Well, you know, let's go on. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jason in San Jose, in Salinas. I'm sorry, Jason. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks so much. I'm a professor of communication studies, and one of the base tenets of our discipline is that perception is reality. So I guess my question would be, does it really matter what we send, since we have no way of predicting how it will actually be perceived?
Hmm. Well, I think Jason has a point. But I think I said earlier, would it have mattered if the Arawak Indians of the Caribbean had lots of conferences and discussions and, you know, study groups and all that about what to say if they were ever visited by Europeans? You could say, you know, that would be interesting for them, but it wouldn't have made any difference.
Hmm, interesting. Let's go to Catherine in Minneapolis. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
Great discussion. I would just caution your panel to not to assume that the other culture is going to be more advanced than us. For all we know, they could be equivalent to our Middle Ages or Stone Age and have no idea about the technology. My suggestion is to avoid a heavy bias on putting in a lot of Western culture things. I would want to go to some of the Eastern Oriental cultures or African. And a couple of my suggestions would be the Buddhist monk throat chanting, or a gong being struck, or anything with African music, you know, just to do a sampling of what our entire global variety is. But I really like the monk chanting. That's amazing. So thanks. It's a great discussion.
All right. Thanks for your suggestion. I think there are multicultural things on the old record.
There are, and I think Alan Lomax did a fantastic job of curating music that is representative. I believe there are only two pieces by American musicians on out of the 27.
Yeah, and of course, the caller doesn't need to worry that they're in the Stone Age, because if they're in the Stone Age or even the Middle Ages, they won't have the technology to ever pick up this record.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's something not to worry about then. We talked about this as a thought experiment, but do you think there will actually be a chance to send another golden record up into space at some time in the future?
Well, I've been thinking about why the golden record was sent and what were the conditions out of which it arose. And I think President Kennedy was the great visionary who really enamored Americans with the cosmos. And he was an idealist president. So I think we will need another idealist president in order to embark on such an enormous and ambitious mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but actually the idea for the plaques that were on the Pioneer 10 and 11 came from a fellow by the name of Richard C. Hoagland, who was working at NASA, and he said, look, this is going to be the first bit of human-made hardware to leave the solar system. We ought to put a builder's plate on it. And that's what started. It didn't really start at the presidential level. But look, there's a much better way to send information into space than to put it on a rocket and you know, blast away. It's just to go down to the local antenna with a transmitter on it and send it into space at the speed of light. And after all, we sent a Beatles song, you know, to the North Star in 2008, or NASA did. So, you know, we have been doing that kind of thing.
Stan, what are your thoughts on the possibilities, the probabilities, the likelihood of this ever being discovered? And maybe there, as Seth says, maybe there's a better way of sending stuff into space.
Well, there's already been a thing called the Cosmic Call that you can look up online. And a couple of guys worked out a kind of a cosmic language, a sign language or written sign system. And they sent it from a radio station in the Ukraine at 150,000 watts, which should go out, you know, 50 light years or so before it degrades. And so we are sending messages out. I don't think anybody's going to get them, and so I want to follow up on something Maria said earlier, that this is a symbolic gesture that's saying who we are, and so it's an expression of planetary consciousness. It's part of globalization, that we as a species are aware of ourselves as a species in a way that is somewhat new and growing stronger. So we send this out. And I've been thinking that it's kind of a secular replacement for prayer, or it's a kind of a prayer. So in a prayer, you say who you are and what you understand, but also what you're thankful for. So we give thanks for, you know, music and birdsong and children. And so if you think of it that way, it begins to organize it into a meaning that isn't purely semantic. Mm-hmm. And I think then the aliens might be able to see that. But if there are no aliens there, then we ourselves see it.
And it becomes beautiful. And it would become an exercise. And if we did do this again and got the whole world involved, it would become an exercise in self-examination.
And also an exercise,
yes,
in finding what we have in common versus all the differences that are being thrown in our faces in today's culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good place to end it. I want to thank my guests, Maria Popova, founder of the website brainpickings.org and an MIT fellow. Kim Stanley Robinson is science fiction author, widely known and most notable of the Mars trilogy. Seth Chustak is a senior astronomer still searching for extraterrestrial intelligence in outer space. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure.
Growing up, you probably had a pop-up book or two on your bookshelf, right? You'd pull a tab and maybe a cow's head might waggle from side to side. Ooh, how cute. Well, pop-up books have come a long way, and it is all for the better. Today, these cutouts are feats of engineering prowess. There are pop-ups that have movement and give a sense of time, and some of them can reach nearly 2 feet tall. Our video producer, Luke Roskin, visited the studio of Matthew Reinhardt, who is a pop-up book virtuoso. He put a film together, and he's here to tell us about that visit. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Wow. So these books are amazing. The amount of detail goes into each pop-up. What does his studio must look like? It's crazy.
It actually looks like a standard artist studio. You know, he's got a lot of tape, a lot of paper, just scissors and an X-Acto blade knife. He's got a computer that he does some compositing work on, but for the most part, it's all handcrafted. And of course, his walls are just lined with Transformers. He's obsessed with Transformers.
And in his video, he actually shows you how he makes these pop-up books. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing seeing how he goes, you know, just from an initial idea and straight into, you know, this completely elaborate, you know, 1 foot pop-up.
I'll write out an outline, just a basic idea of what the pop will be. T-Rex head bites reader. That's it. I don't know how it's going to happen with all the engineering. I just know that that's what I want to happen. The next step is actually engineering by hand. Like, there isn't a computer program that does this stuff. It's like low-tech engineering. We're using really simple stuff, me cutting up paper and folding it and taping it. If I use like an artist tape, that makes a nice hinge.
Hmm. And in fact, that T-Rex that he was talking about, you have open in front of
you.
Oh,
yeah.
So is that one of your favorite books?
Oh, yeah. This is the one that you know, if you can actually hear it, it's a whole lot of pieces of paper.
Amazing.
This is the one that I, when I first got my kid a pop-up book, 2 years ago, I opened it and this T-Rex just lunged out at my son and I. And it really does lunge about a foot off the page. It's got a full head. It's just a marvel of engineering that this is just paper. It's just paper.
And they have so many moving parts on it, right? That's really the magic of this. How do you get them all to work together?
Well, you know, exactly. That's what I found very intriguing about this, especially from an engineering and technology and science perspective. It all starts with a V-fold. So if you put your hands together and then you open them up, you create kind of a V. And that kind of movement is generated off of the opening of the page.
Right.
The opening of the page is the engine of everything. And so you have this paper, and it opens just like your hands would open.
Like that.
Now, think about this. So the wider you open your hands, takes longer to reach that arc, to get them open that far. So
right.
The wider the V, the longer that pop will take. The narrower the V, the quicker it will actually take. And so in that regard, you can actually program or engineer different timings of different pops. And also, when you think about it, that engine, you know, if I add another V off of one V, I can change axes. So, you know, instead of just moving in one movement up and down, I can now move left and right just by adding a V to a V and then attaching that to the base page.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow here with Luke Groskin talking about these pop-up books that are just fantastic. So actually what you're doing, what he's engineering, is how to change the opening process, the sort of horizontal into a vertical thing where things pop out, right? Different axes of working on that.
Absolutely.
And does he make these all by hand in the video?
Everything.
Single cut?
Well, it all starts with just taking paper and cutting up and adding tape. You know, eventually they have to replace the tape with either glue or put slats and things like that in order to connect these things. But it is all handmade. There's no computer program that actually can put together this elaborate structure one that hasn't been invented yet.
So, all right, you've got the T-Rex open there. What's another favorite one of yours?
I absolutely love the Princess Leia pop that's in his Star Wars
book. I have that one here.
Yeah,
I gotta
if you look at it, it's that iconic moment when Princess Leia takes off her hood, and And, you know, you could have just made a pop where, you know, as you open it up, Princess Leia takes off her hood. Instead, the pop, you open the page and you can see this woman, you know, this iconic image of the woman with her white cloak. And she's not fully revealed quite yet. And then, you know, after you reach about 150 degrees, that right. last 30 degrees, that's just, when the hood comes down.
Oh, that's like icing on the cake. It's unexpected. That's what's so
yeah.
wonderful also about these books. You just don't know what to expect when you open the page up.
Well, these books, they're for adults and kids, but, you know, they really do capture kind of the wonder of you know, reading a book and being kind of surprised. You never know what's going to happen when you open one of these pops.
And I also love the Maura Sendak book.
Oh, yes. Book. Yes. There's a pop-up book, and it's a collaboration between Matthew Reinhardt and Maurice Sendak. And he has a pop in that where this werewolf rises up and he's holding a chain. And you get the book open about 90 degrees and the man becomes a werewolf. And then as he pulls up the chain, a little hobgoblin comes out of the sewer attached to the chain. But you don't actually get to see that until the very, very end after you've opened it. And you know, it's a testament to kind of the careful engineering of how far off the center of this page he's able to actually get a movement, a really significant movement. And it all comes down to V-folds and angles and a little bit of math, actually.
Does he ever know how long it's going to take to make one book? I mean, is there
months, years? It takes several months to make the book, and then it takes a year to kind of, or 9 months to actually produce it, to actually hand make these books. Because all these pieces have to be die cut, and then they're machine cut, and then they're put together by hand individually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at the Star Wars book, and it's a beautiful book, and say for the first time, Luke, the Force was with you when you went over to see.
Well, thank you. I mean, these pops are absolutely, they really are works of art, and you know, they really are works of engineering.
Yeah.
If you check out the video, you'll see, you know, there's a lot, there's not just artistry going on here.
What's the video name up on our website?
It's called Engineering the Perfect Pop.
And you're in there and looking at it's a great video.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for putting that together. You can watch our pop-up video on our website at sciencefriday.com/pop-up. That's all the time we have for today. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Ruskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. As we say, our video pick is up there on our website. You can also go there and check out all those submissions you all made for the record. And they're all up there and being curated on our website. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.